From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we look at the week in politics, starting with the firing of FBI Director James Comey.
Plus the role the group College Possible played in the college career of several young Milwaukeeans.
The low-income students who have made it to college, that small percentage, you know, still need a lot of support. They have a very difficult time with family obligations, with lack of financial support.
Plus, an SAS recounts an unusual lesson ahead of Mother's Day.
And some tunes and a talk with jazz trumpeter Eric Jacobson.
The ultimate goal, I think, is, you know, eventually being able to improvise and the sounds are you. But you have to start somewhere from there. You know, you can't just pick up your horn and say, hey, I'm going to improvise and that's it.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There's never a dull moment in Washington these days, but Tuesday produced some especially not dull times. President Trump fired FBI Director James Comey, citing the way he handled the investigation into the use of a private email server by Trump's opponent in the presidential race, Hillary Clinton.
Meanwhile, that throws into question the future of the FBI probe into potential meddling in the election by Russia, which is sparking calls by Democrats and even some Republicans for an independent special prosecutor on the case. And that is where we begin our look at this week's news. We heard last week from Charlie Sykes, our analyst this week, joins us by Skype from Madison. Ruth Conniff is editor-in-chief of The Progressive magazine. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, great to be with you.
So there are a lot of people asking a lot of questions in the wake of James Comey's firing on Tuesday. What are the chief questions you have at the time we're recording this, which is Wednesday afternoon?
Well, yes, to be honest, right, it could change. I mean, the questions could change. I mean, there was just a news conference in which the White House press corps was barred from watching Trump meet with Russian officials, and yet the Russian press was allowed in. So that just, it's just the strangest, most surreal period in American politics in my lifetime. But here at the Progressive magazine, you know, we've been around for more than 100 years. And my first impulse was to jump back to 1973 when Nixon fired the Archibald Cox, who was investigating the Watergate scandal, because the parallels are just so obvious. And what's interesting to me, you know, first of all, there's the question about what happens to the Russia probe, because clearly the FBI was investigating Trump officials, advisors, and campaign members' connections to Russian officials and whether they knew about or were involved in Russia tampering in the election, and had, you know, begun to subpoena people and information connected to that. So what happens now without Comey there? And can the Senate potentially in any way continue looking into that? Because in Watergate, we had a bipartisan group of people in government who stood up and said, this is not acceptable. And could that happen potentially in Washington? So I talked to a couple of people about that this morning. I talked to Lisa Graves, who used to be here at the Progressive magazine. She runs the Center for Media and Democracy, does a lot of investigative work herself, has worked under Attorney General Janet Reno, was an attorney in the Justice Department, has also worked as a Senate committee staffer in the Judiciary Committee. So I asked her that question, and she said, absolutely not. Not only is Mitch McConnell now publicly saying that he doesn't think there should be any investigation of the Russia ties in the Trump administration, but even if you had a bipartisan investigation, it's not likely that they could ever leverage the kind of power, the tools that the FBI has to investigate, the law enforcement tools. So, no, the Senate can't do that. There needs to be a special prosecutor, in her view. But also, you know, it's just the constitutional crisis that we face. And what's different from the Watergate period is that our media environment is so different and the country is so divided into silos that the big question to me is, can we as a country come together in a shared perception of the facts around this and really defend our public institutions and our democracy.
Well, and what especially strikes me at this point is how the tables have turned between liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats. We had a Democratic outcry about James Comey's role in the Clinton email investigations and Republicans defending him in the time right around the election. And now, to some degree, the roles seem like they're reversed and we're all kind of getting political whiplash here.
Well, it's even more twisted than that. I mean, it's not just whiplash. We're on some kind of roller coaster loop-de-loop because the Trump administration is using Comey's public statement about investigating Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server as the pretext for firing him when Trump is on the record praising Comey for doing that. And, you know, arguably it tilted the entire presidential election in Trump's favor. So it's if he was going to respond to that, if that were really the reason, why now? So it's very surreal. And I think one of the problems that we have is that we've grown so accustomed to that kind of nonsense from Donald Trump that there's kind of dishonesty fatigue. And I mean, I think there's a sense in which it's a very successful and deliberate strategy to say things that are not true and to lean into repeated assertions of falsities in order to just wear people down. And you know, so that sense of moral outrage in the Watergate era, one of the things that the Progressive magazine said in its editorial at the time was that, you know, we've all become terribly disillusioned, but this is a positive thing because now we can really have a realistic view of government. I don't think that's true anymore. I think that people are getting cynical, and that is a danger. There's not as much confidence in a robust democratic process that doesn't allow for corruption and stands up for the public interest now.
At the same time, you mentioned Mitch McConnell, but Arizona Senator John McCain told a group of foreign diplomats this week that he still does expect more shoes to drop. What shoes might you expect to drop at this point?
Well, you know, that depends largely on the Senate. I mean, the FBI is in a holding pattern. They're leaderless, and we don't know who's going to be chosen by Trump to be the new leader at the FBI. But I think it's an agency that really tries to maintain the appearance of nonpartisanship and is, you know, frankly, I think freaked out by what just happened. So I don't know how an investigation is going to move forward there. And therefore, I don't know how we're going to see more revelations unless they're just in the form of leaks. I do think that there's going to be a strong campaign to appoint a special prosecutor that, you know, but we have Jeff Sessions now as Attorney General, and he is completely in the tank for Trump. So it's an interesting time. Maybe people like John McCain and other Republican senators will come out and say, look, we know enough to know that this is unacceptable. And, you know, it's not just the, you know, there's sort of a Cold War tinge to the Russia connection. And I think a lot of people on the left, including The Nation magazine, have really denounced the knee-jerk response to Trump having a Russia connection as bad because of a kind of a Cold War mentality that's dated. But there's no doubt that a foreign government meddling in our election is big news and bad for our democracy, and that, you know, it's a repressive regime. But I think more to the point, you know, the corruption. I think there's a lot of corruption allegations with the Trump administration. We just saw Jared Kushner's sister in China making promises to Chinese businesses. The idea that within the Trump administration, there's a lot of self-dealing and that it compromises the interests of the United States, I think that's something that a lot of Republicans are going to have to wrestle with and think about where they really want to come down on that.
All right. So let's turn for a moment to travel across the Atlantic here. France elected a new president last weekend and handed the far-right candidate Marine Le Pen a pretty resounding defeat. In the days leading up to the election, though, there were some who looked at the possibility that that election might mirror what happened here in November. Not so much, as it turned out. What was the difference that resulted in Monsieur Macron's election?
Well, I think that the French had watched Trump elected across the ocean and were somewhat alarmed by that.
Never Trump is a stronger point in France than it is in the U.S., apparently.
Well, I mean, I think there was a real sense of caution, like that this is a global phenomenon with Brexit, with Trump's election. There is a sense that, you know, this is not just a single protest vote that you're casting potentially, but part of a right-wing populist surge that has some echoes, particularly in Europe, that are very unsettling for people. There was not a lot of enthusiasm for the centrist Macron, but there were people on the left who couldn't bring themselves to vote for him. But I think at the end of the day, Le Pen sees it as progress for her very far right group that they did as well as they did and that they have moved into the mainstream. And it is, you know, they have substantially improved their position electorally in spite of their very virulent anti-Semitic and racist and anti-immigrant rhetoric. So, you know, they're moving into the mainstream, and that is still worrisome for France. I think for Europe and for the idea of a European Union, and just as a pushback against an increasingly ugly nationalist strain in politics, it's really positive news.
And at the same time, there seems like with every election in Europe, each successive election seems to be the biggest and most important yet.
You know, I think the other thing that's interesting about the contrast between the United States and France is that France doesn't have Fox News. And so there was a Russian hacking scandal there as well. But the information that was dumped on the press by the, you know, at the very last minute before people voted happened during a period of mandatory candidate silence and non-campaigning, which we don't have here. And there isn't really, you know, the rise of Fox News and the decades-long creation of this right-wing echo chamber that really can take advantage of something like hacked emails mixed together with fake news, a term that's been hijacked by Trump, but, you know, propaganda that can influence the campaign, there is a healthier public debate in France that doesn't elevate that to the level it was elevated in the United States. So I think that protected them in some ways from interference in their election.
Well, finally, we have a couple minutes left. Let's briefly shift to Wisconsin and an election that is still more than a year off. Wisconsin Democrat Mike McCabe threw open the possibility he might stage a run against Scott Walker in 2018. What do the Democrats need to find at this point in time as far as a viable candidate goes, considering Scott Walker's approval numbers are still not all that great here?
Well, first of all, it's interesting that you call him Wisconsin Democrat Mike McCabe, because Mike McCabe's an independent and has started an organization called Blue Jean Nation, which makes a really strong point that it is neither Democratic nor Republican.
Quite right. I apologize for the misspeak.
Well, no, but I don't think it's, you know, I'm not correcting you so much. I certainly think he'll run. You know, I believe he's running within the Democratic Party. I believe ultimately that movement that he leads to take over one of the major parties is not likely to be taking over the Republican Party anytime soon. But this is the thing, right? We have an outsider candidacy with Mike McCabe modeled on, I think, the Bernie Sanders campaign, where there's an independent candidate who's very critical of the Democratic Party, who is trying to reignite, a sort of a socialist populist strain in politics here. And Bernie Sanders did very well in Wisconsin. He won the primary by 13 points here. And it's an intriguing idea that Mike has articulated, which is that the Democrats have not done enough for low-income voters, the kind of FDR Republicans his parents were in rural Wisconsin, who really knew why they were Democrats, because they could point to rural electrification and other things that happened, you know, in the New Deal that benefited people. And he thinks that's where the Democrats need to go. They need to be that party again. And I think it's a very persuasive argument that the organization that he started, Blue Jean Nation, I don't see having a huge membership or having taken off since he launched it. So I think it's reasonable to ask what kind of infrastructure is there going to be in his campaign? And is it going to be the kind of campaign that can take down such a well-financed and well-supported candidate as Scott Walker? But, you know, Wisconsin's very divided, but it can't be that we can't make the case that, you know, the shape that our economy is in, the cynicism, the transfer of wealth to the rich, the attack on our public education system, that those things are unassailable and popular, because they're not. So I'm interested in seeing Mike's campaign and other progressive campaigns that try to take a shot at really doing something new.
And certainly the campaigns in the past against Scott Walker have been much more conventional.
Yeah, it's a very different campaign from the Mary Burke campaign, from Tom Barrett's campaign. And the Democratic Party has had a theory that it should run a centrist, good-looking candidate who can get a lot of corporate funding, who's right out of central casting. And I think that we have tried that now 3 times in a row and seen it not work. So I think we should be looking elsewhere. I do. I think it's a good idea that we start thinking about, you know, what happened with Bernie Sanders and what can we learn from that going forward.
Well, Ruth Conniff, thank you so much, and we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, great. Great to be with you.
Ruth Conniff is the editor of the Madison-based magazine, The Progressive. She's going to join us from time to time as one of our growing roster of news analysts.
Coming up next, the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service profiles several students getting ready to emerge from college. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. When reporter Andrea Waxman met Nuri Plasenia 4 years ago, she was a graduating high school senior planning to major in interior design. Now she's a graduating college senior with a justice degree from Mount Mary University, in part thanks to a program called College Possible.
College Possible is a regional organization which helps low-income students get into college. The program also offers support and coaching while students are in college and connects them with resources at their schools.
For the last 4 years, Waxman has been profiling Plasenia along with 3 other students for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. Now, all the students are on track to graduate, with 2 taking the stage this Saturday. Waxman spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about the series and explains how she first met the students.
College Possible provided me with a list of people who participated in their program, and I just chose these 4 randomly. 2 of the young women were students at St. Joan Antietam. They all live in Central City, Milwaukee, all 4. And 1 student went to Alexander Hamilton High School, which is kind of in the southwestern part of the city. And then the other student went to the Milwaukee School of Languages, and she grew up in Sherman Park.
So all of them are from low-income families?
All of them are from low-income families, and 3 of them are from immigrant families.
How did that affect their college search initially?
I think that the main impact that their low-income status had on their search was that most of them wanted to stay local. They didn't want to get too far away from their families. Part of College Possible's service that they offer is to help connect these students with financial support, because none of them come from families that can pay for their college. But that didn't necessarily limit where they applied, because they could apply for any number of scholarships to any school. So one of the students went to Marquette, which is a lot more expensive, say, than UWM. But I don't think her low-income status impacted that decision. It's just that most of them want to be closer to their families and their communities.
Was there a reason for that they cited when you first talked to them?
I think they come from close-knit families, and they are all children of parents who didn't go to college. So I think there was more uncertainty about what it would mean to go to college and their relationship. All of them also help their families. So they don't just have as much freedom to just go off and live their own lives as many other students have. They need to continue to help their families, and they also benefit from the support of their families.
And many of these students did continue to help their families, which we'll get into in a moment. But when we're talking about low-income students, one of the things you address in your most recent piece about College Possible is the odds that many of these students face once they get into college. So what are these kids facing when they step through those doors?
Well, in terms of statistics nationally, Kelly Scher from College Possible, the program director there, provided me with statistics that say that nationally, only 11% of low-income students who go to college graduate within 6 years. Among students of all income groups, 58% graduate in 6 years. For those students who go through the College Possible program, the percentage that graduate is 54%.
And all four of the students that you started following 4 years ago are either going to graduate this year or are on track to graduate within the next year.
Yes, that's correct. Two of them will be graduating this Saturday, May 13th. One is going to add an extra semester. So she'll be graduating with her class, but she needs to finish up a little bit of coursework next term for various reasons. And then the fourth student is going to need to take another year.
And he specifically faced a number of obstacles. Now, all the students had obstacles during their time in college. There is this perception that, you know, once you get to college, that's really what takes a lot of effort, and that once you're there, everything is easy sailing. And when we talk about these issues, we often use this term, obstacles. But what are these obstacles? What are the things that stand in the way of graduation?
I think that's one of the things that's really interesting about looking at for individuals to see what kinds of obstacles specific individuals faced. So the young man that we just referred to who needs to take an extra year, Peter Kanthavong, he's the youngest of in a large family. So his mother is older than many college students' parents are. She's a widow. She was caring when he started college. She was caring for an older brother of Peter's who was developmentally disabled and had a lot of health problems. At the beginning of Peter's sophomore year, that brother passed away. And since then, his mother has become ill with fairly serious kidney disease. She needs dialysis. So after his first year, he returned home to live at home from the dorm. Partly to save money, but also to help his mother, who was under a lot of pressure. And he said to me the last time I interviewed him that he was really glad he had done that, because even though he was mostly thinking of saving money and helping her, he realized after his brother died that she really needed his emotional support also. So he's also providing a lot of financial support for her.
So beyond just living off campus, which in and of itself can be difficult for students in trying to keep up with their studies, you know, late night study sessions, the many benefits that go along with being close to campus, he also has to work a lot. And all of the students, it seems, worked a lot outside of their classwork.
Yes, all of them did. One young woman who was at St. Joan Antietam and went on to Mount Mary University, in addition to the 300 service hours that she does every year as part of her scholarship program, she's also working three part-time jobs and has from time to time worked four. Currently, she's working a full-time job and a part-time job and then an occasional job in addition to her schoolwork and her service work.
One of the students who you mentioned, Panu Shong, she lived off campus, it seems, all 4 years. And she expressed an issue that I think a lot of commuter students also have, really making a friend base.
Yes. Panu actually moved into the dorm at the beginning of her freshman year. I took pictures of her moving in. I interviewed her. She was very excited. And within 2 weeks, she had to move out again because she was pursuing a degree which would enable her to become a physician's assistant, a five-year program. And that program had so many prerequisites. And she knew that she would need to go to summer school. And when she moved into the dorm, she hadn't realized that her scholarships would not cover summer school. So her solution was to move back home, out of the dorm, and save the money that she would have been spending on the dorm for her summer school tuition.
I think part of what we think about, especially with college and education in general, is that it is this great equalizer. But it seems as though students, specifically those who have to commute and specifically those from low-income families, miss out on the networking opportunities that are often why people go to college. They always say it's not about what you know, it's about who you know. Did it seem like these students were able to kind of bridge that gap between low-income students and the other students at these schools?
I think that most of them were able to. I think Panu, who went to Marquette, had the hardest time with that. I think there are fewer low-income students at Marquette. For Peter, making the social connections was a very high priority. During his first year, he chose to live in a dorm. He was very nervous about having a roommate and whether or not that would be comfortable for him. So he chose to live in a single. And at the end of his freshman year, he told me that he regretted that decision, that he would have really liked to have had a roommate. And that first year, living in a single and having to work a lot, I think he felt like he didn't make as many friends as he wanted to. So toward the end of the year, he connected with a Christian student group. And in his sophomore year, he really focused on his social life. It hurt his grades, he said. But he said he doesn't really regret it because he made a lot of friends with among the Asian student organizations and the Hmong student organization and this Christian group. And also, UWM has a student support services program for low-income, first-generation, and disabled students that provided him with a lot of access to other students that he befriended. So now that he has such a strong social network, he's focusing more on, you know, kind of making up for the lack of studying that he did in his sophomore year.
Now, you've been talking with these students for 4 years. How have they changed? A number of them switched majors, and it seems like they've grown in a lot of different ways.
They really have. That was such an interesting thing for me to see them. They were so young when I first met them. They were still high school students, and they were excited and idealistic and scared. And at the end now of their 4 years in college, they're much more confident. They're much more thoughtful. They really have learned a lot from their classes. Of the four, three of them changed from what they thought they would major in. In some cases, there were academic and other barriers that stopped them from pursuing the majors they really wanted. But those two who said that are also at peace with their decision and still see many opportunities in the future and feel like they're better suited to the majors they switched to. Actually, all three of them feel that way. And then Darnisha, who is the one I mentioned who had so many jobs, she was working in a assisted living home for seniors when she was in high school. And she always had that side of her that seemed very mature, someone who could take care of old people and people who have really serious problems. This year, she's working with people who were convicted of crimes but were not incarcerated because they were deemed to have mental illness. So you could argue that these are the most vulnerable people in our community, and she just loves helping them and working with them. And it's hard. She's in her early 20s, and I think she's very mature to be doing that kind of work and loving it. She also worked in a hospice facility where people were dealing with life and death. But every one of them has matured. Nuri Plasencia, who wanted to be an interior decorator, now wants to be an immigration lawyer. She connected with Voces de la Frontera, the immigrant advocacy group, and has been very inspired by her work there and really connected with justice. She changed her major from interior design to business and then to justice, and she's really passionate about that work. Peter was going to do computer science but changed to information technology, which is a little bit less mathematical, partly because the mathematical part was a struggle for him. But he's got a wonderful internship, a job working for an e-commerce company. He just has many, many options career-wise once he does this. So Darnisha is the only one who stayed with her original major, social work. She's so well-suited. She's planning to go to graduate school immediately in social work. But I would say they're all happier, more confident, always hardworking, and appreciative of the opportunity they've been given. A good takeaway for people is to just kind of recognize what it takes for these young people to accomplish what you know, many people in our society are trying to accomplish, to become educated and develop their potential as much as possible.
Andrea Waxman is a reporter for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and she spoke with Joy Powers. Waxman has been covering the college experiences of four students involved in the College Possible program for the last 4 years. For more information on the series, head to WUWM.com.
A Lake Effect essayist explores a somewhat unlikely lesson she gained from her mother when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Mother's Day is just a few days off, and many of us will take the day to consider the lessons our moms imparted on us or are still imparting.
Count Lake Effect essayist Carrie Carlson in that group.
Like most people over 60, I grew up with daily, sometimes hourly, nuggets of wisdom from my mom. I pretended to listen, then dismissed her words as I carried on in my kid-centered orbit. Really. How many 10-year-olds listen to their mothers when they say, "Don't cross that bridge until you come to it"? Later, I realized Mom knew what she was talking about. When my youngest brother was 2, he had a severe case of measles-induced encephalitis. Guy went to bed one night just like every other mischievous 2-year-old and woke up with garbled speech and a damaged brain that brought his physical and intellectual development to a standstill. After his brain was irrevocably damaged, my parents' lives took a sad, unexpected turn. That's when Mom and Dad learned to cross their bridges one at a time. Guy's life, from that morning on, presented nonstop challenges, including my parents placing him in a psychiatric hospital when he was 18, where he was miserable. After he returned to a brief residence in a group home, they found him an apartment. Mom crossed many bridges in the quest to find my brother his angle of repose. She kept her head up, didn't look too far out, because the future was scary, and crossed those bridges one at a time. I call that survival. For me, I try to live in the moment, face each bridge as it comes, and try not to concern myself about the unknown future of which I have little or no control. There will be many difficult crossings. It's all in the timing. Those words of wisdom, the ones I ignored, came from generations of hard-working farm people, my maternal ancestors. They lived by those rules. There were no therapists to help them with adversity. So when Mom said, "There's no problem that doesn't have a solution. You might not like it, but it's there," she might have meant Guy. In my teen years, I had a different take on the problem-solution issue. My problems revolved around boys, parties, and looking good. Mom's problem was how to afford college for me. Her solution was a long string of crummy jobs so I could help pay my tuition at the University of Wisconsin. She made that clear to me at age 15. If I hated my summer jobs working at resorts in northern Michigan while my friends ran free, so be it. If I wanted to go to college, I had to work. She was the queen of frugal. I heard far too often, especially as a teenager, "If you don't need it, don't buy it." Try telling that to a 16-year-old whose friends have cashmere sweaters while she is forced to dress in cheap Orlan. When I complained, she brought out, "If wishes were horses, beggars would ride." When all I wanted was one long-sleeved pink cashmere sweater so I didn't feel trashed among my high school crowd. She could have denied me the expensive sweater because she believed handsome is as handsome does. Her way of suggesting, let us not become too vain about our appearance. But no matter how hard I tried to care for those ugly sweaters, they were always covered with little pill-sized balls of fuzz that shouted, "Cheap." Vain I wasn't. I just wanted to fit in. Mom's words speak to me often. When a seemingly impossible situation comes up, I think, there's more than one way to skin a cat, and search for options yet to be discovered. When something trivial upsets me, don't make a mountain out of a molehill comes to mind, as does don't cry over spilled milk. Now I'm grateful for all the wisdom poured into my unresponsive head, gifts from my parents, and especially Mom, who articulated them while Dad listened and nodded. They burrowed deep into my soul. When I raised my family, I turned into my mother. I smile when I hear my four children repeat the same advice to their children, echoing the wisdom of the woman who raised me. Years ago, I hung a wooden plaque in my bedroom that Mom, Dad, and I created with a wood-burning scent, a gift for my 10th birthday. Their combined wisdom, encapsulated in three short sentences, no platitudes, no cliches, just plain, simple language. Here's what we burned into that wood. I resolve to mind my manners, to save my money, to keep my room clean. That said, I would add, remember, don't cross any bridges until you come to them. As for those sweaters, I don't wear pink, but black cashmere looks really good with faded jeans. Mom is gone now, but I'm sure she would approve.
SES Carrie Taylor Carlson, a former environmental educator and outdoor guide, now reviews restaurants for Urban Milwaukee.
One last break, and then we'll jazz things up with Milwaukee trumpet player Eric Jacobson. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. For some, jazz is a way of life. That's the way it is for trumpeter Eric Jacobson. Locals may know him as part of the Wisconsin Conservatory's jazz sextet We Six and as a regular with the Latin jazz band De La Buena, but he's also performed nationally with the likes of Grammy Award winners Brian Lynch, Benny Golson, and Tito Puente Jr. He's produced two live albums and a studio album with his newest album, Discover, coming out soon.
In addition to playing, he runs jazz combos, teaches lessons, and books local and national artists for the newly renovated Jazz Estate on the east side. Lake Effect's Mayan Silver invited Jacobson recently to come by the performance studio to play some tunes and to explain why jazz is such a special art form.
Awesome, Eric Jacobson. That's great. Thanks for playing that. It's like a marathon running,
all right.
Huh?
Like it is. Well, it's a lot of air. You're using so much air for trumpet.
Yeah, so it's a tough instrument.
I would say it's one of the hardest ones.
You got to train with marathons or something.
I ran a marathon.
That's amazing. Okay, trumpeters and marathons. Yep. Never associated it, but I guess that's... So can you tell us what that was?
That was a tune called Chi-Chi, and that was by Charlie Parker. I'm kind of coming back to that tune because that was one of the first tunes that I learned when I was eighth grade.
So, wow. Yeah. Is that when you were starting to play trumpet?
No, I started pretty young for a trumpet player. My mom and my dad and my uncle and my grandpa played trumpet. So I ended up starting when I was in about third grade. So
wow, that's
so I've been playing for a long time now. I finally passed the 30 years of playing the trumpet.
That's amazing.
I don't know if that's a good thing or not.
No, it's a good thing. That's a good thing.
But no, that tune Chi-Chi was something that Eric Moronis, a great tenor saxophone player from Racine, introduced the tune to me, and I started working on it then. And you know, it's just a beautiful tune.
So what is it like now, 30 years later, trying to revisit, or not quite 30 years?
But I hope it's better. But, you know, the understanding, I think back then it was more about just grasping onto some phrasing of Charlie Parker, trying to see what I could do to just emulate anything I could from him. But now it's more like, how do I put my own style to it?
Well, speaking of style,
you really want to create your own style when you improvise. What are you trying to do when you improvise?
That's a great question. My teacher always told me, try to tell a story. So when I improvise, as much as I can, I want to convey a story, you know, a beginning, a middle, and an end. So within the chord changes, I mean, that's just, it's super difficult to, you know, you're thinking about what chords to play, what notes to play. You're trying to change rhythmically, but you're also trying to tell a story. So,
local jazz legend, Berkeley Fudge, he's a saxophonist.
Yes.
And he said that playing jazz is like a language, just like when you're speaking. So when you're speaking, you're not necessarily knowing exactly what's going to come out of your mouth as you're talking, but you use the language that you've built over the years to be able to say something. And there's not just one way to say something. You know, you can express to someone that you're angry at them or happy with them or whatever.
Yep.
In many different ways.
Absolutely.
Is jazz kind of like that?
Yes. I mean, you know, I love Berkeley Fudge, and I've learned so much from him. And in fact, that's how I teach as well, is, you know, how I explain when you're improvising. It's a language, you know, so if you can think about that when you're really young and you're trying to learn words, it's not easy. You're pronouncing words and you're learning the definitions of words. And sometimes it's not so natural to say the words or into a sentence. It's just like that with improvising. So it takes a lot of time and effort, and also it's not always spontaneous because you're trying to work it out in the practice session where you're over and over and over going through these vocabulary scenarios. Eventually what happens is hopefully it becomes where you're not thinking in the moment. Just like when you're speaking, hopefully you're not thinking of the word constantly. And I think all of us have probably have done that before, and if you do, it doesn't come out very well. So the idea is to not think when you're soloing. I know that sounds kind of funny. So just like we just talked about with, you know, learning a language, it doesn't always have to be a lot of notes. It doesn't always have to be a lot of words, if you want to think of it that way. Let's say you're learning three notes. The analogy is you're thinking three words as well. So I'll play a blues. I'll play the whole scale first so you can hear that, and then I'll pick three notes out of that and improvise with those three notes.
Cool.
Here's the blues scale. Now what I'll do is I'll play three notes and we'll go from there. One, two,
what you just did, you weren't thinking ahead of time, oh, I'm going to play the B flat and then the E flat. You were just kind of in there and going with the flow of which notes you wanted to play?
Correct. Like I did say to myself what notes I was going to play
right
beforehand.
But not the order or not the exactly order. How nope. You would play them.
Nope. And, you know, sometimes when you're just getting started with this, I always tell students, you can get away with playing one note. It's how you, you know, tell the story with one note.
Yeah, so there was different ways. You know, sometimes you held on to the note longer. Sometimes it was more staccato. Sometimes it was softer.
Right.
Sometimes.
Just like what you said about what Berkeley Fudge said. You could say the same sentence so many times and come across differently every time. You know, whether you're loud when you say it or quiet, how you articulate it, or how slow you say it, how fast you say it. You can make it sound exciting, but it's the same sentence, right? So that's what I love about improvising, because it seems to me that it's never ending, and that's a beautiful thing to me.
And then the solos that great jazz musicians have played generally aren't always written out.
Correct, yeah. Most of the great players out there, they don't have their books written out for them or anything like that where you can read their solos. There are some out there, but I highly recommend transcribing the solos. And transcribing is doing it by ear, you know, listening to the solo. That's how I did everything when I got started. Every teacher that I had said, you need to listen to it millions of times and then be able to sing it back and then take it from there onto your instrument.
That's insane. See, the only thing that I ever did like that when I was a kid was the song Bust a Move by Young MC. I learned all the lyrics.
I tell all my students this, that I guarantee you almost everybody has transcribed in some way. They don't realize it. Like when they're listening to the radio and you can sing back the lyrics, that's transcribing and you can sing along with it. You know, that's what it is. Now the difference is you're taking it onto the instrument that you play. And then what you do is you study it. You understand why it sounds so good. And that's then another spot that you take from there is you transpose. And that's taking something that you learned and put it in all the keys that you can. Actually, on YouTube, I put out 2 videos now about transcribing. So if you're ever interested in checking that out.
When these great musicians like Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, John Coltrane, when they have phrases and stops and pauses and ways of saying things, does that sometimes influence you with your ideas for the future?
Well, absolutely. See, what you can get out of transcribing and listening to somebody like, you know, Charlie Parker is if you do it by ear, you're learning not only the vocabulary that he's playing, but you're learning the articulation, how he phrases, and the technique of that person. If you do a lot of these, and what happens is, you know, you start to get different type of artists in your own playing, it becomes kind of your own as well. That's, you know, the ultimate goal, I think, is, you know, eventually being able to improvise and the sounds are you. But you have to start somewhere from there. You know, you can't just pick up your horn and say, hey, I'm going to improvise, and that's it. Just like when you were born, I mean, can you imagine saying, no, I'm going to do my own language? You know, so people help you learn the language that you're speaking.
That's really interesting because you are trying to find yourself, mm-hmm. you know, in how you express yourself.
Absolutely.
In so many different – and yep. music is a perfect example
yep.
of that. Do you go to a different space in your head when you're improvising?
I hope so. I'm going to give a shout out to my friend Al Anderson, who just did an interview. And just like, I hope I'm not quoting this wrong, but it's called mindfulness. How improvisers are thinking and not thinking at the same time. It's a hard thing to explain, but you go into a moment of almost out of body experience at times. It's happened for me. And it's such a neat thing because you're just kind of going with the flow. Your ears are listening to everything that's going around you. But then there's those moments when you're thinking too much. And that's usually when my story ends right there. And I have to start over again. So for improvisers, I really got to say it's a tremendous amount of focus.
But also the ability to let go.
To let go as well, right. It's a two-way street there.
And so clearly we have a unique circumstance here because it's just you with a trumpet, and improvisation can start there. It can
absolutely.
Just be one person, one instrument. But
yes.
you're tending to play with a rhythm section, mm-hmm. piano, bass, drums. How is that different?
You know, when you're improvising with yourself, I mean, it's a good way to get started to get comfortable with a scale maybe you're working on or trying to follow changes on your own, which is a difficult thing to do. When you add instruments, it's opening that story even more because you're not only improvising now with yourself, you are with somebody or, for example, a quartet, you know, and I'm last night just got done playing and I can remember hearing and listening to the drummer and specifically the snare drum and basing my solo off and around that rhythm that I was listening to. And at the same time, hearing a guitar player play something behind me, a chord that I follow along with as well. So it's multitasking.
Your ability to listen and hear what those other instruments are doing really affects what you're coming up with as well, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Sometimes you can be really strong in your own individual improvising where you take the story and they follow. But I love it when we're all together and there's that moment where we're following the story together.
I think it was Cornel West or somebody like that who said that jazz is like democracy.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Everybody's playing and listening.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And kind of trying to create something together.
Together. It's a team effort for sure.
What does teaching music add for you in addition to playing?
You know, I love music, all music. You know, jazz is just that music that really makes me enjoy the day, you know, life in general. And I also love teaching the music. That's such an important thing for me to carry on something to somebody else. Like, I love music so much that I hope that I can teach it to somebody to love it as well. So
that's great. And you're also booking local and national acts for the Jazz Estate. How important is it for Milwaukee to have local venues like that for jazz to be heard?
It's so important. You know, I mean, we could practice all day long and stay in our closets and practice, but if we don't have a place to play, you know, it means nothing to anybody then. You know, you just have the record. That's it. There's nothing better than seeing something live, you know.
And you've recorded a few of your albums at the Estate, it seems, right?
Yep.
The Jazz Estate. So what does that venue add to the experience of making the jazz?
For me, it's been a stomping ground since, you know, I was in college. Seeing people play there and then being able to actually record there means a lot. But recording live is a unique thing because it is spontaneous in a sense. You can't go and edit anything. It is completely live. So that's why I like doing that. So you're not thinking. When you're in the studio, sometimes you overthink things. But
it makes it a social environment too, right? You know, like you're sharing it with people.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when I said seeing live music, that's one of the main reasons why I'm playing music is actually going out and seeing a trumpet player, the name Dizzy Gillespie. I got to see him when I was in sixth grade. And, you know, it changed my life. I can remember telling my parents, that's what I want to do, you know, watching him play.
That's so cool. It was great to hear you talk about jazz, and it'd be wonderful if you could play us out. So thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Trumpeter Eric Jacobson is a member of the Wisconsin Conservatory's jazz sextet We Six and a regular with the jazz combo De La Buena. He spoke with Lake Effect Mayon Silver, and our recording was engineered by John Strelecki. You can learn more about Jacobson at WUWM.com. And that's the Thursday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock. Fresh air is next.